And really, it comes down to the fact that a lot of folks are never going to be comfortable biking on a street where there's lots of traffic if the only thing that's separating them is a line of paint of a bike lane. So there's kind of two, I mean, there's lots of strategies within the bike plane, but there's two that I, you know, really think kind of rise to the top. One is separated bike facilities on major streets and arterials. So, you know, cycle tracks or, you know, lanes that are either grade separated, you know, or have some other kind of physical barrier between the traffic. And then the other part of our network is what in Portland we call neighborhood greenways.
Well, that's my guest today. That's Stephanie Knoll. She's with the BTA in Portland. And we'll get into all that in just a minute. But Stephanie, I met her on the Queen Mary during the Alliance for Walking and Biking's leadership retreat just a few weeks ago. And I think I go to these conferences, I know I do, to meet people like Stephanie, bring them back onto the show so that you can meet them too. And in particular, one of my motivations is that opening statement there. It's in the middle of the interview and you'll hear her elaborate on it, but my wish is that more cities could leapfrog to what Portland, Vancouver, Boulder, and other cities are doing, as opposed to evolve in the same straight line, you know, sometimes excruciating path that it seems like we're all destined to. Could we make the leap and move from painted bike lanes and a few sharrows all the way to separated bike lanes? Well, Stephanie's going to get into all of that and much more. First, it's time to introduce myself. I'm Frank Peters. I'm your host. This is my show, CDM Cyclist, where I interview people in the world of bicycle safety. And Stephanie, of course, referencing Portland's bicycle plan for 2030. And I'll have links in the show notes to that plan where, you know, one of the first things I learned in bicycle advocacy is plagiarize. Many people are ahead of us. Learn from them. They'll be happy that you stole their ideas. So check out Portland's bicycle plan for 2030. Speaking of Portland, I'd like to tip the hat to my sponsor. That's Bike Tires Direct. More than just bike tires. I just bought a new set of lights. You know, the days are getting shorter. Some of those LED lights, the batteries last longer. The lights themselves are brighter every year. I just went for a new 500 lumen LED light in front and one of the new turbo flashers in the back. It's that time of year. I got mine, Bike Tires Direct. Check them out, please. BikeTiresDirect.com. Well, Stephanie, we've got a lot to talk about. Let's get right to it.
I'm Stephanie Knoll from the Bicycle Transportation Alliance in Portland, Oregon.
How would you describe? I mean, you're a membership group, you're an advocacy group, all of that?
Yeah, we're a statewide nonprofit organization. Our mission is to create healthy, sustainable communities by making bicycling safe, convenient, and accessible. So we do work on the policy and infrastructure level and law and, you know, legislative level to advocate for the policies, the laws, the on the ground infrastructure that'll make biking safe and convenient for folks. And then we also run a lot of education and encouragement programs just to introduce folks to the joy of biking and to teach folks how to operate safely with other vehicles on the roadways.
Mm-hmm. Now, the BTA, of course, everybody knows that Portland in particular, Oregon in general, I suppose, big bicycle community, big bicycle state. BTA probably deserves more than a little bit of credit for that, huh?
Yeah, in a lot of ways, the Portland's, you know, bike scene and the BTA have grown up together. The BTA has been around for more than 20 years, advocating in the Portland metro area, and there's definitely a lot of projects that, you know, we feel like we can make a direct claim to seeing happen when they did.
Mm-hmm. Now, just to compare and contrast, in my hometown here in Newport Beach, California, the mayor 3 years ago convened a bike safety committee. You know, we're appointed by the city council. But BTA doesn't have those kinds of connections. Your involvement with local government, you're not a separate nonprofit.
Right. So we are a separate nonprofit, but we do work really closely with local and state government in a few different ways. We do have some government contracts to do our safety work, to do our education work. And then we also just over the years have really built strong relationships both with our decision makers, you know, our mayor and city council, and also with the folks who are doing the actual engineering and planning for our transportation system. So, you know, at the same time as that we're not part of the government and play an important role in that we aren't part of the government and are separate from the government and therefore can advocate in ways that you know, both public officials and, you know, publicly appointed folks cannot. We also really recognize the importance of working really closely with those staff.
Mm-hmm. In the spirit of the grass is always greener, it would be easy for me to be jealous of the BTA, but perhaps you too. Do you admire, are there other kinds of like bicycle groups or advocacy arrangements like BTA, but different that you admire? Other cities, other states?
Certainly. I just came back from Pro Walk Pro Bike and in Long Beach and got to hear a lot of what was going on across the country. And there was a lot that I was inspired by other groups. Really neat to see what the community bike shops are doing in terms of engaging new folks in the movement and in work. And we really definitely have some lessons learned, lessons to learn from other groups in terms of doing a better job of engaging kind of new folks and underserved communities in the work that we do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's where we met, Stephanie, is at the Alliance on the Queen Mary. It was a great venue for our event, wasn't it? Kind of different.
It was fun. It was a little, sometimes a little creepy winding down those long hallways alone. But no, it was really fun to be on that yeah. boat.
Yeah. How about what fun things did you do in Long Beach while you were there? You get out on a bike?
Yeah, a little bit. I didn't make it on any of the tours, but I really had fun the first afternoon I was there, just finding my own way across the bridge and onto the bike path around along the marina and down the beach. Really enjoyed that ride. Also had some nice walks through town with some other folks to see some of the more in-town bike infrastructure that's popped up, and enjoyed having dinner one night in a parklet outside of a restaurant. So,
yeah. Mm-hmm. How about impressions? If my friends in Long Beach were listening, any advice from the BTA, any suggestions? Long Beach has done a lot, but what suggestions might you have for?
You know, I really, really enjoyed, you know, seeing what I saw there, and wouldn't claim to have gotten a taste of the
sure.
whole Long Beach experience, but I think just focusing on, you know, really creating a whole network, I feel like there is some great snapshot, you know, kind of moments of infrastructure in Long Beach, but really making sure that there's a clear network for someone to navigate across the city on, you know, bike facilities that are going to feel safe and comfortable.
Mm-hmm. That triggers a thought. Now, I probably told you, Stephanie, my son and I went to Portland this summer. I think it was July. We spent a week there going to the UBI bicycle maintenance class. Are you familiar
uh-huh.
with them?
Yeah, I commute by their building every day.
Oh, that was fun. Now, I stayed in Southwest Portland, so I had to go over the Broadway Bridge every day.
And then turn north. That was, talk about, you know, a great route across the city. It was only 3 or 4 miles, but I got a great sense of commuting across the city.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, overall, I'd say Portland is a really fun, easy place to bike. We still have neighborhoods that are not well served by our bike infrastructure. I think the city's aware of that and has really written a great 20-year bike plan that really does, you know, in that plan bring facilities and close reach of all Portlanders. Of course, now we're still hoping to see that plan fully funded, but
mm-hmm. Yeah, never. There's always issues, right, with funding. Yeah. Now, I looked to Portland, and recently to Vancouver hosted a big, land use planning, bicycle walking conference too. One of my favorite subjects these days is separated or protected bike lanes, and we looked to Portland for that. Let's talk a little bit about protected bike lanes. Because when I go over the Broadway Bridge, mm-hmm. I think many people who might picture a large bridge over a major river like that might find it a little, they might be a little apprehensive. But the Broadway Bridge, for example, I was completely separated from traffic, both coming and going. Is that new or...
Well, most of our bridges, so let me back up a little bit. The Willamette River kind mm-hmm. of goes through the middle of Portland. And so there's many bridges, across for folks to get back and forth and from the east to west side. And the majority of those bridges do have separated facilities that are shared facilities for cyclists and pedestrians.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, that is really the common scenario on our bridges these days. And, you know, most of those facilities are at least 10 years old on most of the bridges. And it was really interesting. I was talking, we recently had a event at the BTA, reaching out to some of our former board members,
mm-hmm.
To just hear their stories and reconnect them with our current work. And it was really fun to hear stories, particularly about the Hawthorne Bridge, which has 10-foot paths on either side that are shared facilities for cyclists and pedestrians. And they were talking about when they won those paths, first got those put in place, they just seemed, so huge and even decadent, I think was a word that someone used. And they just felt like, we will never fill these paths, and now, one of the most frequent, complaints, especially from new bikers, is that, it's scary to bike over the Hawthorne Bridge now because of the volume of bike traffic.
Wow.
on those paths. And, that can feel intimidating to a new rider. And folks are, now looking towards, we've got a totally new bridge that's going in. That's going to be a transit pedestrian and bike only bridge.
Oh, wow.
And then we have another bridge, our Selwood Bridge, that's about to get a major overhaul, essentially be another new bridge.
Oh,
and now, folks are really advocating for facilities that are wider than the Hawthorne and also that have separation for both cyclists and pedestrians.
Mm-hmm. I think it's important for, like in Southern California, many of the communities taking their first steps towards improving cycling safety and building the next wave of infrastructure. And one of my laments is, I hate to see every city here taking the same steps that every other city did. First you put down some paint and then maybe some sharrows. We should look ahead, look to what other cities are doing and kind of leapfrog our way to some of these, newer infrastructure projects, I guess.
Yeah, there's a lot of exciting examples out there. Certainly some within our country and, even more from Europe.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've heard it said before, you've probably heard it said too, Stephanie, that, well, you people in Portland are just different. All this bicycle infrastructure that we see there is just because culturally people in Portland are just so prone to it. And what I've heard when I meet people like yourself is that, no, these were all hard-fought battles too. Just you started much earlier than everybody else. Portland's not really composed of different kind of people. Plenty of people in Portland drive cars too, right?
Certainly. I mean, it's funny. Our bike modes, you know, mode share, mode split might be, you know, way higher than other countries in the U.S., but it's still, you know, 6% is our mode split for bikes. So, you know, when you think about that, you know, in terms of who makes up a city, you know, a city where 6%, you know, of trips are by bike is not that much different than the makeup of a city where it is 1% or, you know, another number. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So overall, I'd say we have had to fight the same battles, and, you know, it often has been, you know, a matter of political will, you know, to get something done. Just like it is in another city where someone, you know, who really wants to come in and make a difference does. Every city is going to have its own unique set of challenges and opportunities. And that's true in Portland. And, you know, we did have some interesting opportunities. We did have a statewide, bike bill that's kind of, I mean, we refer to it as the bike bill in Oregon, but it really is kind of an early complete streets bill. Mm-hmm. And that's been on the books for decades. That says, you know, a certain amount of, you know, 1% of the funding of a total road project must go towards bike and pedestrian facilities in the right of way. So that's been on the books for a long time. Now, you know, a lot of other cities are establishing their own complete streets policies.
Mm-hmm. Now, that came up even last night in our bike safety meeting chaired by the mayor. She proposed that next year we consider changing our name to be a complete streets committee. One of the advantages of that is perhaps you double your constituency, right? You get pedestrian walking advocates in the tent too, huh?
Right. I mean, I think we work really closely with kind of all the active transportation interests, and, you know, depending on what the specific, you know, project or policy we're working for is, we work really, really closely with transit, or even work with freight, or, you know, work with some other interests that people don't always see as aligned, depending mm-hmm. on the issue.
Mm-hmm. And that 1% that you mentioned, I can imagine that years ago when that first was implemented, that sounded like a really small, throw a dog a bone kind of number. But 1%, that'll fund a lot of bike stuff, doesn't it?
Certainly will fund a lot of paint.
Yeah, right.
which, you know, is kind of where things often started. And it really is. I mean, I think our bike planner with the city of Portland often refers to bicycling, you know, building for bicycles as a cheap date. The infrastructure does not cost a lot. The amount of bike infrastructure that we can build, you know, for the same cost as, you know, a mile of urban freeway, you know, would really make our city the city we really dream of being as far mm-hmm. as head bike connectivity.
Mm-hmm. What are the thoughts to grow from your 6% mode share? I'm sure there are plans to, how do you get to double digits when you're a city like Portland?
Well, I think the city of Portland, and, you know, the advocates and citizens and everything that informed our 20-year bike plan saw a couple of things as really key to continue to attract people who aren't already biking in the city. And really it comes down to the fact that a lot of folks are never going to be comfortable biking on a street where there's lots of traffic if the only thing that's separating them is a line of paint,
right,
of a bike lane. So there's kind of two, I mean, there's lots of strategies within the bike plane, but there's two that I, you know, really think kind of rise the top. One is separated bike facilities on major streets and arterials. So, you know, cycle tracks or, you know, lanes that are either grade separated, you know, or have other, some other kind of physical barrier, between the traffic. And then the other part of our network is what in Portland we call neighborhood greenways, and which other folks might be more familiar with, known as bike boulevards. But these are, you know, low traffic streets that are often adjacent to an arterial, or at least near, you know, near an arterial. But they're low traffic streets that are where there's traffic calming measures put into place so that they become less appealing to drive on. But they're very appealing bike streets, and you know, things have actually been done to you know, at the same time that traffic calming measures have been put into place to limit or slow cars, other features have been put into place to actually make them streets that are, you know, faster or easier to get to one place to another on a bike. Like, you know, and signalized intersections are, you know, have a signal that's, you know, right on at street so that, you know, cyclists can trigger the signal or, you know, or a sensor, or, you know, stop signs have been turned so that, you know, a cyclist traveling on that street isn't stopping.
I can picture
every other intersection. So
I can picture a street like that in Palo Alto, and I had family in Palo Alto. They moved to Portland though. But I could ride from my favorite hotel in Palo Alto to the campus at Stanford on, I think it was Park Ave. And it was a bike boulevard. And like you said, you'd go a certain number of blocks and then cars could not proceed through that intersection. It'd be blocked off, but little pathways so the cyclists could scoot right through. So cars had to turn right or left so that through traffic, nobody was going to, you know, make time by cutting down the bike boulevard in a car. And that would go a long way. Well, that's great.
And those facilities are also overall really inexpensive to build because you're not, you know, you're not installing major grade separation. So I think that's, you know, that's an example of something that doesn't cost a lot to build. The generally the neighbor, you know, they're often on residential streets, and the neighbors on those streets really often end up appreciating kind of the other benefits.
I like the way you use the phrase eventually, because well, there's opportunities for resistance to change too, right?
Well, and I think it's just, you know, folks who might not be biking themselves, you know, hear that the city is going to, you know, enhance their street for biking, and I think they think, well, how's that, you know, how's that serve me at all? And then they find it does serve them by making their street a, you know, a quieter, safer, you know, pleasant place to walk, or, you know, to enjoy being on their front stoop, or, you know, or whatever it is.
Well, that's great. Well, Stephanie, let's change gears, because as you and I first met, you started telling me about some of the software that BTA uses. And BTA has been like licensing or selling the software to other bike coalitions. Bring me up to date on that.
So we have a commute tracking platform that we first started to develop in 2008 and have been evolving ever since. And we run our month-long bike commute challenge in the month of September on that platform. And it's just a really fun, easy-to-use website where individuals log their trips. They compete on teams with their coworkers. They get, you know, instant feedback on as they, you know, build up miles and build up calories burned and CO2 saved, and can see what they're doing as an individual, what their team is doing, and what the challenge overall is accomplishing. And also has a lot of fun features where, you know, individuals can issue direct challenges to each other. Teams can challenge each other or join leagues based on geography or, you know, type of business. And it just really, it's a really, really fun platform, that we've used, for several years now to invite new folks to, to mm-hmm. try out bike commuting for the first time, to give workplace, you know, bike advocates a vehicle to kind of share that with their coworkers, and also kind of to highlight what workplaces are doing out there to be more bike friendly workplaces.
Mm-hmm. So this is another like aspect of the fact that BTA, you know, 20 years old, you've got lots of resources. Like if we were to start a group like BTA in Southern California, we said, geez, we want to organize rides and competitions like this. Oh boy, it would be like looking up at Mount Everest, writing all the software to facilitate that. But you've got that.
Right. We definitely don't want other communities to have to reinvent that wheel. You know, we've been investing in and tweaking, you know, the software for years now. Mm-hmm. And this is in fact the second online platform that we've used over time. So we've really road tested it already, and have been really, really happy to create licensing agreements with other groups so that they can use it as well without investing the same amount of time and money and, you know, energy that we have in the process. So
I'll bet
Cascade mm-hmm. cycling up in Seattle, and Des Moines, TrailNet in St. Louis, and Bike Coalition of Greater Philadelphia have all used the same platform that we created now, mm-hmm. at this point.
Mm-hmm. So what's it like being like a bicycle advocacy group? And to some extent now you're in the software business just a little. What's that transition been like?
Well, I would say that my original, you know, approach to this was, I don't want to be in the software business. I'm a bike advocate. I've been excited to share, you know, like I said, I've been really excited for other, you know, other peers of mine to not have to reinvent the wheel and to kind of share what we have with them. In terms of figuring out the best way in which to share the software, you know, that's been a learning curve that I don't think that we've completed yet. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right now, you know, we've licensed the source code to various organizations. So everyone is running their own sites, which have now, you know, all forked from each other and are being, you know, hosted and managed separately and everything, which in some ways works great for other organizations and that everyone has kind of total control over their site. But there's a lot of inefficiency in that model as well. You know, we have agreed that we would share any improvements that we make to our site, you know, over a certain number of years with other groups we've licensed it to. But, you know, they all have their own costs now associated with integrating any improvements
and
that
we make. Of course, some of them are going to do a better job than others of, you know, taking that software and growing it. Yeah. So what do you see the future? Your software licensing, is it going to be more of like software as a service, or how do you see that growing?
Well, I'm certainly right now kind of seeking some mentors, you know, from the software service industry, to, you know, to potentially partner in sharing the software in a way that is, you know, is a more, you know, overall kind of can serve one's needs in an even more efficient manner, in which we can, you know, continue to share the updates that come along, and you know, share good ideas among the other folks that are using the same platform. Mm-hmm. You know, certainly the nature of software is that it can't stay static and continue to meet the needs of a changing world.
Well, that's true. That's absolutely true. I can relate to your situation here, Stephanie. I wrote enterprise software for Wall Street, and they were demanding customers, and I would develop a nice feature for one, and then I'd have to tailor it so that I could make it available to everybody else, and I had quite a learning curve with that, and so did my clients.
Yeah.
So I can relate. Well, that's great. Now, Stephanie, how about somebody listening to us on the show here? They want to find out more about your software and how it might work for them. How should they make contact? What's the best way?
Well, they can contact me via email or phone. They can find my contact information on the BTA website, which is btaoregon.org. My email address is Stephanie, Stephanie, @btaoregon.org. And also I just would encourage anyone to just check out our platform, which is at bikecommutechallenge.com. And definitely play with it. Invite anyone to create a login, see how it works. You know, invite other folks from your community to join a team so you can kind of get that full feel for that interface. Right now our website, we do keep it up year round, and there are some folks in some workplaces who do use the platform year round to track trips, although we focus our programming on the month of September.
Mm-hmm. Well, Stephanie, it's been nice to get to know you better. It's been nice to get to know the BTA, too. Thank you very much for joining me on the show this morning.
All right. Thank you. Enjoyed talking with you.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, we're back in the studio, and hope you enjoyed getting to know Stephanie Knoll. Of course, as she starts talking about software, my ears perked up, you could tell. So, of course, as we wrapped up after the interview, I volunteered to be a mentor to her as she looks to, take her software in the next steps in a new direction. It sounds like a lot of fun. I'd love to help her. Well, I've got other interviews up my sleeve. Met so many people between the Alliance's retreat on the Queen Mary and Pro Walk Pro Bike. Some very exciting people going to share with you over the weeks and months ahead. One coming up in just a few days. So be sure and come right back. Visit the website where I have links to some of the things we've talked about. CDMcyclist.com. If you're like me, it's hard to say goodbye to Stephanie. So we had a delightful little warm-up discussion before the interview actually starts, and I couldn't just delete that and throw it away. I thought you'd enjoy these last few words with Stephanie. Bye-bye. Stephanie, tell me, where'd you go to high school?
I went to high school in St. Louis, Missouri, at a school called Koryezu.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And Stephanie, the headset microphone, just
yes.
the microphone part, if you move it just below your lips,
like okay,
to the bottom of your chin kind of alignment there.
How is that working?
Good. Say, please pass the pickles.
Please pass the pickles.
See, my guests will say just about anything I ask them to.
Well, I know that you're probably trying to get rid of those plosive sounds.
That's right. Exactly. Hey, now,
I'm a square dance caller, and I with certain kinds of mics, that's a real issue. You know, the placement in terms,
yes,
of all those plosives.
So you're a square dance caller. I don't know that I've ever met one before.
Oh, well, you have now.
Oh, that's great. So my parents were ballroom dancers. They started with square dance, and they were great dancers. So that's what you do, huh? You?
Yeah, although I call dances for the masses. Oh, I mean, yeah? I call a lot of dances at weddings and parties, at a lot of places where people don't expect to find themselves square dancing.
And now, a square dance caller, I'm trying to get my head around this, it is like you call out moves and it's like narrated.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Are there other dances like that are called, so to speak?
Well, yeah, in the American tradition, there's also contra dancing, which mm-hmm. is fairly similar, which is also a called dance. And then I think there's, in other traditions, there's called dances as well. But oh. I don't know that much about kind of the traditional
mm-hmm.
dance scenes of other countries. So,
well, Stephanie, we're just getting to know each other. So I got to tell you, I'm a dance photographer.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I've done it for many years. I've photographed at the High School for the Performing Arts in New York City is where I got my start, the Fame School, years ago.
Right? This is now ringing a bell from when you introduced yourself at the Alliance kind of retreat in the fundraising session.
Yeah,
you
had mentioned it then, huh?
Story, yeah.
Yeah, that was fun. Well, it's nice to get you on the show. Let's properly introduce yourself, Stephanie, please. Would you state your name and your organization, please?